Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. Through our events, publications, and podcasts, we provide the space and opportunities that Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox scholars need for professional growth and intellectual discipleship. Since 2012, we have been building a network of friends with a love for our core themes, tradition, place, and things divine, and with a genuine commitment to the church and the life of the mind. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. That's C-I-C-E-R-O-A-O-I-A. Well, it's in the show notes. I'm not going to try and spell it. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society, and before we get started, please join me in prayer. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, we pray, O Lord, that you would bless our conversation, and that all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. I am grateful to be joined today by my friend, Professor Josh Kraut. Josh Kraut is an associate professor of French in the Department of World Languages and Cultures at Hope College in Holland, Michigan, where he has been on the faculty since 2016. He received his PhD in linguistics from Georgetown University, and we found out a few months ago, I used to live in Washington, D.C. I went to the Catholic University of America. I was living in the basement of folks that were Josh and his wife's friends at their church in D.C. We didn't know that until we both moved to Holland. Dr. Kraut teaches courses in French language, literature, and civilization at Hope. He is also co-director of a great program called the Emmaus Scholars. It's a group of faculty and students that fosters Christian intellectual community through shared meals, discussions, and worship. And he is currently finishing a translation of essays and lectures by the French philosopher Fabrice Ajage, who is the subject of this episode. Bienvenue to the show.
Merci, merci, Josh. Thank you very much.
I have no idea how to say to the show in French, but I think I got the bienvenue.
That's right, yeah. You're sitting at already a B+ if you were in one of my classes, so you're doing pretty well.
Oh, fantastic. That's way better than what I got before. I think I just, when I took French for reading in grad school, I think it was a pass-fail by God's grace. Anyway, so Josh and I attended the same church here in Michigan, and a while back, I learned he was translating and studying the work of this French philosopher who I had never heard of at all, and I'm guessing that many of our listeners have never heard of. And that's actually, Josh, you know, you have not had a chance to be at one of our conferences yet, but one of the things that I like about the Ciceronian Society is we really love the idea of learning about thinkers that no one's heard of before, but you should hear about. So this is a very Ciceronian topic. Anyway, so Josh, I heard from someone else at church that Josh was translating this guy, and our friend Aaron, he said, yeah, Josh is translating the French Wendell Berry. And you responded, well, kind of like the French G.K. Chesterton. And I thought, well, who? Either way, I need to know about this guy. And so, because let's just say he's both. And what I did learn about him very quickly on the internet makes me think that y'all need to read this guy. So I want to start with just a very basic question. Who is Fabrice? Where is he from? What does he write on, and so forth, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. Well, thanks again, Josh, for having me. Fabrice Ajage is a philosopher who's currently living in Switzerland, though he's from France. As he describes it, he is a Jew with an Arab name and Catholic faith. So he grew up in a kind of secular Jewish family. And had a dramatic conversion to Catholicism as an adult. And he writes on a whole variety of different topics, really a kind of Renaissance man. He's a musician. He's written children's books. He's written comics. And he's a cultural critic in his main focus, I think you could say, is on the human person and materiality. He writes a lot about transhumanism and technology. And I had come across his name in a journal that was, there was an article on kind of Catholic intellectual renaissance in France, and I'd never heard of him before, and so I decided to pick up some of his stuff and was immediately wowed by he's a real wordsmith and funny, and so but doesn't write in English, and as far as I can tell has only given a couple of addresses in English, even though he speaks very good English, and so was fascinated to get to know him a bit better.
Yeah, so did you meet him personally? Because you lived in France, right?
Yeah, I did live in France for a few years, but I've not met him in person. I've spoken to him, through Zoom, but no, I haven't met him yet. He's a busy guy. He directs an institute called the Philanthropos Institute in Freiburg, Switzerland, which is a year-long program in philosophy, theology, and performing arts. It's kind of introduction to the Catholic spiritual disciplines, too. It's a postgraduate program, so people who finish college, mostly Europeans, who attend that program. In addition to writing, I think he's published, 32, 33 books. He's in his early 50s, so this year he's already published 2 books. He's got a very large family, and I don't know how he does it. He's certainly... certainly a genius of some stripe, and I've managed to secure an hour-long conversation with him so far. Other than that, I've just been reading his work on my own.
That's fantastic. I'm particularly interested in the comics. I didn't catch that one. That one's really interesting. Philosopher comics.
I know. Yeah, I've not read the comics, so I can't comment on it.
But you could read them because you can read French, but.
I could read them, yeah. I've read the first installment of the children's trilogy that he's written, and it's good.
What's that about?
L'attrape malheur, so the catcher of evil, or the misfortune catcher. It's not been translated yet, so there's no actual English title. That's about a young boy who's able to absorb everyone else's pain.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's kind of set in a... medieval backdrop, and he has all these adventures. He joins kind of a traveling circus, and yeah,
that premise alone is intriguing.
It is,
and of course also very Christ-like.
That's right.
Which of course is the goal. It's interesting to know. I mean, what was based on the part of his biography that you know, because as I understand, he was previously kind of a secular atheistic Jew, right?
Before. That's right.
And what brought him to faith, to the Catholic faith?
Well, as he tells it, I think from a very young age he had a sense of the gratuity of life, and was struck. I can't remember the exact details of the story, but I remember he tells a story of just sitting kind of on his front stoop, and some prosaic scene was transpiring, or maybe there was a pet that had come up to him, and he just kind of had an epiphany as a young person of how precious and contingent maybe life was. You know, he might well have never have been there, and that was something that attracted me to his work as well. I grew up in a secular Jewish family myself, and but similarly had intuitions that there's a lot more to this life than what I'm seeing spoken of around me. And for a judge, I think he read a lot, and it was actually reading, I think, some of the more militant atheists that ended up converting him, as I think sometimes happens. And so, yeah, I think he went to kind of the cream of the creme de la creme school in France, one of the equivalent of the best of the French Ivies, studied philosophy, but by that point. Was well on his way to seeing through atheist arguments, and as for the specifically Catholic piece, I couldn't say. I'm not sure where that tradition comes in, but
yeah, he's part of the is it called the Pontifical Academy? Is that what he's?
Yes,
or he's elected to it or something, appointed? I don't know how that works.
I'm not sure either. I don't know if it's like a consultative body, or I know he's won pretty prestigious awards for religious writing from the French Academy.
That's fascinating. You're just thinking of the atheist thing. It committed, you know, very, we'll call them, we'll say rational, deep thinking atheists.
Yeah.
Is one of the most interesting people to talk to, because they have, in order to maintain, maybe this is controversial to say, but like, in order to maintain the position of an atheist, you constantly have to reason your way away from the evidence all around you in a way, at least in my view, where you have thought very, very deeply about why the world is not the way that religion has said it is. And so you constantly have to fight against it. And so you're not... I've rarely met, I've met a few maybe, but I most especially educated atheists, they can be very, very interesting to talk to, because they've thought so deeply about questions that shape things. And usually talking to an atheist has actually been good for my faith. I had a colleague at a former university I taught at, and he and I got along so well. Because he didn't agree with me on anything except some politics, but his questions and the way he took things to kind of their logical extreme, like, well, Josh, if you're wrong about this and I'm right, then the logical extreme, you know, the logical progression of thought here is this, and then he would come to some point where, and I really don't like where my thought leads me.
Yeah.
I just can't leave it behind. He's like, I would rather you. And he never said this, but. The impression you get from him is, I would really much rather you be right, but he just didn't want that to be, or he wanted me to be right, but he just wouldn't admit it. But
he wanted you to be right, but he didn't want to admit it. That's interesting. I've heard it go the other way, where was it Thomas Nagel at NYU who has, mm-hmm. who has that famous line of just saying, well, yeah, but at the end of the day, I just don't want religion to be true.
I actually when I was a professor at Hope, I had a student who was at the time, I haven't kept up with him, but he was wrestling with the question of God. He said I said to him at one point, because he kept coming to my office and he kept asking me questions about theology and belief and history, and I said to him, I said, you know, God is not afraid of your questions, so we can keep at this as long as you want, right? And this gentleman said, well, I believe you that God's not afraid of my questions. He said, I'm just terrified of his answers. I said, well, you're on to something, though.
You know, it's interesting. One of my favorite books from Hajjaj is called, again, this hasn't been translated yet, but it's called The Faith of Demons, or Beyond Atheism. And so Hajjaj will, at the beginning of that book, He cites Pascal talking about atheists, and Pascal is very sympathetic to a certain stripe of atheists, right? It's the atheist who cares, who is bothered mm-hmm. by his atheism, and who therefore is searching, as opposed to the atheist who really doesn't really think about faith and is happy just kind of with his worldly pleasures and is indifferent But for a judge, you know, the distinction is very important, and even once we move into the world of faith, it's, you know, this is from James, right? That even the demons mm-hmm. believe, right? That pure intellectual assent is not really the name of the game. That one needs to search with the heart. One's whole will needs to be involved, and it's not just a kind of rational assent that is at the core of faith.
Actually, it makes me think of some of the... I'm not deep in this literature on personalism, Catholic, the notion of Catholic personalism. But you mentioned that a little bit, that he's preoccupied with that question of the person.
Yeah.
Does he dive into those debates about the human person? I'm thinking especially of the kind of the... Karavostia and or Pope John Paul II. I never say his name right, but I, that whole world of Catholic personalism with like Jacques Maritain and others in the mid 20th century who are starting to move in that direction, think through that question. My own former professor David Walsh was in that camp as well. Would he consider himself a personalist in that sense?
I Honestly, I don't know the answer. That's on the list of books of his that I haven't read yet. I mean, he's got a number of books on, he's got a number of books on sex and gender and the family. Most of my reading of him and translating has been the environmental ecological writings. But I mean, there's a lot of resonance. So it wouldn't surprise me if he were in the kind of JP2. Camp, but I can't say for sure right now.
Yeah, well, let's turn to those environmental writings. I've read the one lecture you sent me on the Sabbath of the Earth, which was beautiful. And this is what you're translating primarily, as I understand. And who's is that set? Does that have a publication date or a publisher yet? Or
the collection of translations. Yeah. We don't have a date yet, but I'm working with Front Porch Republic Press to publish those essays and talks.
Well, our entire audience will be familiar with that. Front Porch Republic has been we've been in some ways we were born around the same time and often in some ways among the same people several years ago, and so long history there. And so I'm glad to hear that. So. And I read your talk. I read Hajjaj's lecture. This notion of the Sabbath of the Earth, it's a challenging concept. We don't have enough time to do justice to it here. But explain a little, for starters, kind of the quick version of what he means by that to a point. And specifically, what I was fascinated by was that he was using Leviticus.
Yes.
You know, the book where you say, you know what, I need to read the Bible cover to cover. It's just that's the only time you read Leviticus.
Yeah, that's right. That's the only time. Yeah.
The rest of your life, you're like, do I really need that? Well, a judge has just convinced me that I am wrong. It turns out every word of the Bible needs to be read more than once. What does he mean by a Sabbath of the Earth, and how he uses Leviticus for his kind of environmental hermeneutic, if you will?
Yeah. So the Sabbath of the Earth is I think if you understand that term, pretty literally, could just be referring to the Sabbath referred to in Leviticus, the time that the Earth is meant to be able to rest. So there's a couple of times late in Leviticus where this is mentioned, where one leaves the borders of one's field to be gleaned. By the downtrodden, one leaves the field fallow every 7 years, that's the classic kind of Sabbath of the Earth, and that's the Sabbath of the Earth that the Lord refers to when he says, if this Sabbath is not respected, then then one invites consequences, one invites judgment on oneself as a people, and. Hajjaj uses this image of the Sabbath as a way to understand, I guess you could call it the posture of why care about the environment in the first place. One could give a lot of different answers to that question. One could give a very utilitarian answer, right? Because if you plow your field to its maximum capacity and don't let it rest, then your yield will be increasingly diminished because you've exhausted the land. And so for utilitarian reasons, you might want to have a less plundering kind of mindset to the land. One could think of self-preservation as a reason to care about the environment. But for a judge, the idea is not a practical idea. The ecology and the care for the earth needs to come from a spirit of receptivity, which is the spirit of the Sabbath, right? Which is the act of sitting back and receiving the life you've been given. And not seeking to grasp for, you know, a 24 hours more worth of productivity, 24 hours more worth of value that you could potentially extract from what Abraham Joshua Heschel calls the things of space, right? It's a time to think of the things of time, to receive the life you've been given, and for a judge in thinking of the earth to receive the earth as a gift to be contemplated, not simply to be used. And so that's what he means in brief by Sabbath of the earth.
It's really, you know, that the way he framed that, in the sense of it's not for self-preservation, it's not for utilitarian purposes, that was really, really striking to me. It's been hard for me to think through, and I think his use of Leviticus is part of the brilliance here, in the sense that you and I both know this, like when you're looking at the environmental literature, environmental politics, environmental philosophy, even among kind of Christian environmental thinkers and political theory, there is this struggle to, like, we know there's got to be some kind of theocentric, biblical way to think through this. But trying to find a framework for it has been a challenge. The concept of stewardship, which I want to get to here in a minute, is still really important, and a judge thinks that as well. But the way he's framing that, I think, is very, very helpful. Because I'm trying to think of, like, where the standard environmental narrative or framework is for a lot of these things, but it has not been super helpful. I mean, it's not. You know, these are concepts where, you know, St. Francis may have known some of this, but he didn't really get to it as much. And, you know, even New Testament scholarship has been in some ways unconvincing to me. Like, there is a sense in which it's there. But I never would have thought to look at Leviticus. And you think of the fact that it's still in the Bible. Believe it or not, and it is very, very much dealing with the Jewish people's relationship to the land.
That's right.
And it's such an obvious direction to go. Once you read a judge, you're like, oh, okay. I missed this forever. He's also, for those, you know, one of the things that is interesting in the history of kind of environmental thought here is Christians have been playing catch up for decades, because while it was Christians in the 19th and early 20th century of a type that were certainly turning our hearts and our focus to the environment, to what we were losing in many ways. It also had, historically, there it was wrapped up in scientists and kind of in naturalists, natural philosophy, natural theology. There were those who were kind of, you know, whose relationship to Christianity is dubious. Thoreau comes to mind here. Rousseau, who I would not consider a Christian, would be someone who is certainly inspiring some of this, as well as many poets after him, especially in the French in English worlds that we owe a lot to in terms of generating that. But it's not until the mid-20th century where theologians and serious Christian thinkers are like, well, we better start having something to say here. And to me, this is the first person I know of who's looked at the Old Testament, looked at Leviticus, and said, this is going to be a framework for a truly Christian environmental philosophy, not political, but environmental thought.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. It does lend a lot of credence to, you know, what we call in the English-speaking world the agrarian readings of the Bible. It does seem to, no pun intended, but ground those readings. I think it's funny because he's a philosopher, but in many ways he's writing midrash, right? He's writing commentary on the scriptures, and he does have recourse to philosophical frameworks throughout his writings, but. You know, they almost serve more as introductory framing, but the real heart of, I think, a judge's contribution is commentary, is biblical interpretation. But you're right, yeah, these things have been we've been late to the game.
Yeah.
I think, you know, but it has, you know, there have been a number of popes, not just Pope Francis,
right.
But Benedict and John Paul II before him, mm-hmm. were also concerned with the environment. And a judge is very much in dialogue with especially Francis and the encyclical Laudato Si.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think he does, you know, along with Wendell Berry, who's another writer who's very, very dear to me, he is at the forefront, I think, of reflection on these topics.
Yeah, yeah. And in your lecture, you kind of contrast them, you know, compare and contrast them, I think, in a very, very helpful way. I wonder, I mean, I'd be surprised if Wendell Berry knows who this guy is. But at the same time, you make a really compelling, opportunity for them to be in conversation.
Yeah, I mean, Ajaj is an enthusiastic reader of Berry.
Really?
Okay. He is. Yeah, he never quotes him, as far as I know. But he's been reading him for years. And so I know that there's deep appreciation on that side. Yeah, as for Berry, I don't know. He's so busy writing.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. Also this whole opportunity. I never thought of this, but you know, there is an agrarian tradition in Europe that I frankly know nothing about. I certainly know about the agrarian tradition in the United States, but it's not like we invented that. So it'd be interesting to know more about kind of what to what extent does he see himself as part of that.
Yeah, I mean, he's careful to say that he's not a farmer, and I don't think he claims the mantle. There are at least one other French author who I think probably deserves the title French Wendell Berry, maybe more than a judge, who's Gustave Thibon, who was actually a farmer and Thomist and writer, but yeah, I don't think that a judge would identify himself with that camp.
Yeah. Well, let's continue on this notion of the Sabbath of the earth. And I think this whole concept of Sabbath has been, it's one that many of us as Christians, we've heard our whole lives, if we've been a Christian for long enough, but we've never stopped to think about it. I grew up thinking, you know, well, to keep the Sabbath means you make it to church on Sunday, nailed it. You know, there's way, way more to this. And the Jewish tradition certainly has a lot to offer in particular here that Christians have just forgotten and neglected. And there's two terms that come up in your talk, relinquishment and stewardship, which I think are so important. Let's start with relinquishment. What do you and a judge mean by this? And why it contributes to that concept of a Sabbath of the earth.
Yeah, well, I think relinquishment is let's maybe talk about the foil for relinquishment. A judge begins sure. this meditation of the Sabbath of the earth with a reflection, a kind of biblical anthropology. A question is, you know, who are we as people?
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically the first part of the meditation of the Sabbath of the earth. And then how does that translate to our care for the earth? What connection is there between our personhood and the way we care for the earth? And the key feature that he identifies from the Genesis narrative is that of the Sabbath in the garden, if you will. And of course, there's no... You know, the Ten Commandments are nowhere near on the scene at that point, but a judge points to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil as a kind of sabbatical tree that we are not to grasp, and it is obviously the devil's lie to tell us that we need to grasp it and that our lives would be improved by it, and that spirit of right the grasping.
Mm-hmm.
Which underlies the whole idea of concupiscence, that relinquishment is in opposition to. And so it's only by having a heart that is content to be receptive as opposed to acquisitive, a heart that is grateful for the life that we've been given, as opposed to seeking always more and more, that will... be a sustainable ground for not just caring for the environment, but really any happy human life needs to have that basic posture. So relinquishment, you know, has obvious implications when you think about it for the way we deal with the earth. You know, mm-hmm. kind of fast forward later into the talk. If you see the earth simply as a stockpile of resources, you know, conditioned by your view of everything around you as needing to serve you, then you're going to naturally be tempted to extract as much as you can from it. Consequences be damned. Sorry, I don't know if that's going to bleep out on the podcast, but that's
this is not a rated podcast.
There's no censor. Okay.
No, not here.
Okay. Well, you know, so the Earth as stockpile is a view that one only has when relinquishment is not on the table, when it's not a reflex, when it's not a virtue, and so the kind of constant growth, and Barry talks about this too, this ideal of limitless growth is, you know, it's ruinous for not only ourselves, but obviously for the environment. And you can see, given the state of the world, how we've made a mess of things. And so if we are to, you know, this is like classic Augustinianism too, right? You can't just suppress a desire. You need to show what is higher, right? And relinquishment is also a way to get us in touch with what is higher. You know, there's more to life than you know, than acquisitions, and this should have ripple down effects to our lives as consumers. You know, do I need all of the single use products that I have? Certainly, it may save me some time. But why am I so concerned with producing value out of every minute of my day that I need to, you know, use all these kind of single-use things? And you can think of 100 different examples of ways that we might justify to ourselves doing something that would have negative consequences for the earth on the basis of it being more productive for me, more efficient for me.
Right. And I think, that gets to this you know, a piece of an element of Sabbath keeping that to me is so key here. And this gets to your notion of relinquishment, that one of the biggest things that we're relinquishing is control, right? At one point in your talk, you talk about how, like, look, there is, and this is what a judge says, is to the point that, you know, the whole year of Jubilee, which you've saved up for, or the every 7 years the land gets a break. Well, this is not just for the health of the land. This could go terribly for you, right? If you have not saved up enough, or if something unexpected happens to your store, there's a lot of risk involved in Sabbath keeping, in a way. But there's also it's an opportunity to trust and have faith. And I think this is also true in kind of these broader senses of the term, where we're so just thoughtlessly using and abusing resources that were without kind of any restraint whatsoever. Now I'm something of a raging capitalist, but I also don't think capitalism necessarily requires that you just, you know, use and abuse the earth to endless. It's just a mess, because it's not good for your soul. It's also not good for the earth. Now, and you mentioned this in the talk. You know, one of the things where we're not going with this, with relinquishment, or with like the too much, or like the limits to growth, like that whole tradition from, I think it was in the 1970s. You know, they might advocate for population control, and that's not what we're saying here. Because that's also a fantasy, in a sense that we're also, in a way, our population is going to eventually start to decline in a couple of decades because of the low birth rate. In fact, you know, that's a much bigger problem that we don't need to get into here. But that relinquishment notion is so key here, and we don't have a ton of time, but I want to try and get back to that notion of stewardship, because that's the other side of this coin. So if we're going to relinquish, what else are we going to do, and what does a judge mean by stewardship then?
Yeah, we receive the land as a gift, and when you receive something as a gift, it's grotesque to treat it as if you had absolute control over it, an absolute claim to it. You use it. So there's the concept of the usufruct, right? Using something that is another's without damaging it, without prejudice to it. I think a judge talks about each individual creature in the creation being a revelation of God. And if that's true, then to properly steward means using, and a judge is not, you know, he's not a he's not against eating meat, he's not against, you know, I'm sure he has swatted flies that are buzzing around his head. You know, this is not like a superstitious like don't harm anything for any reason, but we treat the earth with reverence because it is the creation of God. And stewardship, I think, in that context means if we're going to use something for our own ends, which is, in many cases is proper, we don't do it in a kind of wanton way. We don't take more than we need. We don't inflict more damage than necessary, cause more pain than is necessary. And so stewardship has reverence built into it. It has a sense of our place, you know, our secondary place, our place not as gods built into it. And it also has a recognition that it's not, you know, that this is not our ultimate end, right? My ultimate happiness is not coming from the use of this earth. It was given to me. It's given to me as a means, but it's not given to me as an end. And so we ought not to treat it that way.
Now, I kind of know the answer to this question then as a follow-up. So based on what you just said then, can we still have a concept of private property? Or is private property anathema to stewardship? Again, that's kind of a tongue-in-cheek question, but I'd just like to hear what your thoughts are on that.
I think private property is totally licit. You know, it's totally fine. I think it's one understands, one needs to understand what one means by saying, this is mine, right? One needs to understand that this was given to me, right? And therefore, you know, all things he gives to us, and of his own do we give back to him. And so, yeah, I don't think there's anything, you know, on the political level that would put private property in jeopardy.
Yeah, and I think that, and that's kind of what I'm getting at is there's this notion that, of course, this is a very old notion, right? I mean, this is as old as Plato. Where you could think of, you know, is private property an excuse to use and abuse and just destroy something? Well, no, you can do that if you think it's common property too.
Mm-hmm.
But sure. There's also this, if you see yourself in a very conservative Burkean sense of you are an heir. This has been given to you, not only by God, but by, you know, one of the ways that we receive these gifts is that they've been passed down to us. We have inherited them. They are gifts of history, if you will, and people come after us. And so it's like when I think of my house or just things that are important to me, I'm thinking to myself, wow, you know, yes, this is my private property. No, you cannot steal it, but this will potentially outlive me. And so I don't want my kids to inherit garbage, right? And I think there's something deeply, I think when you historicize, if you will, private property, you add that reverence to it and that need for stewardship. Yeah, what were you going to say?
No, I totally agree. And I think that's an important and a fitting note to end on, perhaps, is that, you know, this is when we talk about the gift that we've received, it is a gift that we actively need to pass on. And I think that's part of what it means to relinquish is, right, we're not seeking to feather our own nest at the expense of the future generations.
Right, which is a very radical concept nowadays. Well, Josh, there's just so much more we could talk about here. I want to encourage our listeners to look into this particular thinker, especially if you can read French, go for it. There is a lot of opportunity here, I think, for research. I want to encourage those who are thinking about future conferences for the Ciceronian Society to look into this topic and think through this topic with a judge and others. I think this is very much part of who we are and what we're trying to do, especially with that whole agrarian notes. I mean, this podcast is called The Sower for a reason. It's named after the sower, the parable, but also kind of speaks to our agrarian roots. So anyway, Josh, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Josh.
And if you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider joining us for our 2025 conference, which will be in Harrisonburg, Virginia at the Hotel Madison, March 13th through 15th, 2025. Sponsorship opportunities are also available. Space is very limited, so be sure to register soon. I don't quite know when this episode will be published. My guess is January 2024. Today, by the way, is January 2025. Today is December 10th, 2024, and I need more coffee. So hopefully there are still a few spaces, but sign up for the newsletter so you can learn more about additional and future events. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Thanks for listening.